From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codename Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. It is a Thursday, if you're listening to this on the day it comes out, which means it is time for our weekly listener mail segment. It is, by the way, definitely not brought to you by this thing, Lucky Jack. I don't know, Matt, Noel, can you guys see this, Doc?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that coffee?
That's what it says on the label, but I'm starting to debate it. You know, maybe I've just been drinking trash coffee for so long. I can't drink the fancy stuff. But this is not brought to you by Lucky Jack. Instead, if this is brought to you by coffee, it's brought to you by, and the whole crew knows about this, this oversized carafe that I just keep guzzling.
You're going to die, Ben.
Everybody's going to die. Life's a one-way trip.
Your heart's just going to explode, like, on air. And what a way to go. I mean, honestly.
It'll do a lot for the show, I'm sure. Yes. But before we go gentle into that good night, let's rage against the dying of the light in the form of letters and calls from you. We are going to travel just outside of Bangkok. We're going to hear about what one listener calls the greatest video conspiracy of all time. And before we do any of that, we're going to get a little Red Lodge with it, I would say. We're going to follow up on something we teased in a previous episode. Something about masking. Something about backwards. I know.
Not anti-masking, though. This is a different kind of
masking. No. I don't know about you guys, but I'm pro-mask. Whether or not there's a pandemic, it's just time for the species to admit 80% of human beings look better with a mask on.
I would tend to agree. The type of masking we're talking about today is of the backwards variety, or just back masking, which is a term that was probably invented by lawmakers, puritanical ones in particular, evangelical ones that, you know, back when records and rock and roll and, you know, all of that stuff was very much associated with wickedness and the devil. And there was a lot of witch hunt type vibes, you know, satanic panic type situations involving looking for hidden messages in albums. There's a book I'm actually somewhat close to finishing up. I've been listening to it on audiobook for probably most of the pandemic now, because I tend to fall asleep and then I wake back up and I have to backtrack. But it is called A Boy's Life, and it's by Robert McCammon, who I think you're familiar with, Ben. He wrote a book called Swan Song that I quite like. It's a very good post-apocalyptic kind of situation, sort of like The Stand. It came out around the same time, but it's a lot more gory and kind of bleak, in my opinion. But this book is about supernatural occurrences, but it all takes place in a sort of a small southern town, and there is a part in it where there's a preacher that comes to town who takes the single of Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys and plays it backwards in front of this congregation and says, "You see there? You see that sound? You hear that? That's the sound of these devil worshipers trying to, you know, convince children to come and follow Satan or whatever." And, you know, one of those things where if you listen to it enough, you maybe could hear it repeatedly, you know, like when words start to lose their meaning when you say them over and over and over again, sort of the reverse of that. But it very much was a thing, and there were actually trials that, you know, were founded on the notion that suicides, for example, took place as a result of hearing these subliminal messages. One in particular involved Rob Halford and the band Judas Priest. And we had the email you're talking about, Ben, that we teased. A wonderful email from a listener who has some experience in this subject, very specifically because he is a musician and used to be in a band in the 80s that was very well known, a band from around here that toured with REM, made records for Elektra and Geffen, and had a fantastic career in the 80s and very beloved. They're an Atlanta band called Guadalcanal Diary. Mm-hmm. And Matt, I believe you spoke to Murray on the phone, didn't you?
Yes, I did. wonderful human being. and lots and lots of stories to tell about living a life as a professional musician. Very cool stuff.
Yeah. And one of those stories is what was in this email. So I'm just going to go ahead and get to it. He says, hello, STDers, which I love, by the way. I've listened to the show for a long time and love it. Regarding your 531 2021 classic, Are There Real Devil Worshippers? You mentioned that in Judas Priest's legal case, they stated that had they done backward masking, it would have been a message encouraging listeners to buy seven more copies rather than to praise the devil. He goes on to say, in the 1980s, I was the lead singer in the band Guadalcanal Diary. While in the studio cutting our third album for Elektra Records, at a period when backward masking and satanic panic were current topics, we did something very similar, but for our own amusement. Our guitarist, Jeff Walls, who was also in an incredibly excellent band called The Woggles, an Atlanta kind of garage rock band, who sadly passed away, I believe, in 2019. But I got to play several shows with them back in the day in a band that I was in. Excellent, excellent guitarist. Our guitarist, Jeff Walls, and I recorded the message, Kevin, this is a hit song. Howard, this is a million seller. And inserted it into the mix in reverse. Kevin and Howard were our A&R guys and were responsible for encouraging the record company's promotions department to push specific songs. We were curious to see if it would have the desired effect. It did not. Keep up the great work. Murray Attaway. I thought that was just wonderful because it really does kind of hit home the fact that, A, if anyone was doing this, it was probably for fun or for their own amusement or as like an Easter egg for listeners. I don't think anyone thinks that any artist was actually thinking that by putting something like this into an album, it was going to actually have some kind of like behavior transforming effect on its listeners. But that was exactly what Judas Priest was accused of doing in that court case 25 years ago, or actually the article that I'm reading in Rolling Stone came out in 2015. So this is like 35 years ago or more, a little more. Rob Halford, the singer of Judas Priest, kind of, you know, looks back on this. And the claims that were made about the subliminal messages were things being included in there backwards, like try suicide, do it, and let's be dead. And again, you know, these are things that you could probably convince yourself were in there. Just because when you flip words backwards, they sound crazy and they sound, they're like weird ghosty syllables. I mean, just try it with anything. You could probably convince yourself that it's just about any phrase that you, it's like looking at clouds, right? It's like you're looking at cloud formations and you say, oh, that's definitely a rhinoceros. And somebody else looks at it like, nah, man, that's a, you know, car or like a choo-choo train or something like that. It's all in the eye or the ear of the beholder. And when you start to push a narrative like, oh, this is definitely about trying to kill yourself, especially if the music has dark undertones in the first place, which I never found Judas Priest to be particularly dark. They were almost more on the glam tip. I mean, like kind of this like high pitched kind of like vocal and a little bit, you know, not like death metal exactly. It was almost more like kind of glammy, big, you know, rollicking kind of like theatrical rock. So I always thought it was funny that they kind of got saddled with this. But they did get off for this charge. It was also, by the way, in a cover song, a cover of the band Spooky Tooth's Better By You, Better Than Me, which supposedly, according to the courts or the prosecution, influenced two young men to take their own lives. It was Raymond Belknap, who was 18 at the time, and James Vance, who was 20, that they had spent a lot of time drinking alcohol and smoking weed and listening to this album, Stained Class, after which time they took a shotgun and shot themselves. And I would highly recommend anyone that's interested in this case to check out this article in Rolling Stone from 2015. Called Judas Priest Subliminal Message Trial, Rob Halford Looks Back by Corey Groh. And it's all, you know, from the perspective of Halford himself. And he literally says, during the case, I really wanted to go over to the mother of the boy who killed himself and give her a hug and say, I'm sorry for the loss of your kid. Let's go have a coffee and talk this over.
As long as it's not Lucky Jack.
Yeah, really? Is it just too much?
It's
too,
like spearmints or something. I mean,
oh no, that's not. No, it doesn't work for coffee.
Tuned in. I'm listening, but I'm just I'm just cheap enough to feel like I have to finish drinking it.
I totally get it. And I just think, you know, that level of empathy speaks volumes, I think, to the fact that this clearly was not any kind of intentional, you know, there was no intent behind this other than to just try something clever and be creative. And I think it's maybe the jury's still out on whether they actually inserted those things or if it was just sort of the interpretation of some of these right-wing Christian groups. Ben, did you have any insight on that?
Yeah, I mean, you're not far off with the clouds. It's sort of an audio Rorschach. People are hearing what they want to hear. And you know, we know because we've dove into some explorations of this kind of thing. And we have to remember that, you know, we have the benefit of better forensic audio equipment now in terms of software, primarily, honestly. And at the time, people didn't have that. So if they thought for some maybe sincere reason that this was a tool of Satan worshiping rock stars, then of course they would hear what they were primed to hear. There's a confirmation bias, but I would also advance, you know, this is occurring during the era of satanic panic. There were a lot of people, especially politicians, who personally could not care less. They just wanted to get some votes, wanted to rally their political base. I mean, it's obvious, first off, that if somebody was trying to do something like this sincerely, you know, if like a metal band or no, a metal band wouldn't work. I'm thinking of a different, like if it turned out that band, the Cardigans, they were a metal band once upon a time. If it turned out the Cardigans were secretly devil worshipers and they wanted to put in backmasking instructions to make people do horrible satanic things or whatever that, however you want to define that, then the big question is whether or not it would work. Like, would it induce those behaviors in people? And the answer, honestly, is no.
Of course. I think it's clear. It reminds me a lot of these congressional hearings that took place in 1993 around violent video games. And there's a fabulous episode of this Netflix limited series, High Score. It's about kind of the history of video games from its inception or from their inception to close to modern day. It didn't go quite as far as I would have liked. I would have liked to see like Minecraft and some of the new kind of retro game trends sort of discussed. But it does talk about this time where it was like Mortal Kombat. We all remember walking into the arcade and seeing, you know, Sub-Zero pulling out someone's head with the spinal cord attached. But they're the most, that wasn't even the biggest, the game that made the biggest splash in those hearings. It was this game called Night Trap that was like in the era of full motion video where it was, they're really dumb. It's a really dumb game and very bad. It's like, you know, trying to choose your own adventure, kind of like Dragon Slayer, but like with actual actors and it's sort of like these scantily clad sort of co-eds in like a dorm room type situation. And there are these like murderers that are coming in, but like they just talk about the whole the impetus behind it and how they ended up where they ended up. They couldn't just have like straight up slashers because they knew that would like be way too controversial. So they ended up making them these like weird vampires that had these like kind of grabber claw gun things, but they weren't actually guns. There was this whole thing about what they could and couldn't be. And it was like they were blood sucking devices, essentially. They would like wrap around the victim's necks and suck their blood or whatever. But it was very clear from those hearings that the lawmakers that were questioning it and they were saying this was, you know, absolutely corrupting the youth had never actually played the game or, I mean, of course they hadn't played the game, but hadn't even really seen the context of the scene that they played, which was something involving Matt. You, I could see you nodding. Like you remember what the scene was. It was something like out of context, a scene where a woman gets grabbed through glass or something and it makes it look like, you know, like an 80s horror movie, but there's no bloodshed and there's certainly no like sexual violence or anything like that, but yet they use this out of context to show that this was depraved and meant to corrupt the youth, you know, on purpose.
So first of all, to your point that the people making this decision didn't play Night Trap, that's because not many people had a Sega CD. I'm just kidding. Right. So many people did, but not that many. And not that many played Night Trap. I remember playing it a couple times in a friend's house, and I never got to that scene. And I honestly haven't looked into it. But I can tell you that it was fairly tame, no matter what it was.
Well, let's also keep in mind that, and I think you can agree, I hope you can agree with me here, Murray, about how silly and heartbreaking this is. The utter hypocrisy of politicians and quote-unquote concerned citizens at the time to say we have to watch out for video games. Oh, there's a secret message in a very radio-friendly song that's going to make you go crazy, but let's not talk about how many people we are killing abroad, right?
No.
Let's not talk about how many parts of the U.S. population are being violently repressed. This is very much a pay no attention to the crimes behind the curtain kind of thing. And to me, you know, to me, backmasking is cool. I love stuff like that. I love subversion of form. You know, like you're reading a novel, totally. The page numbers get all screwy. That's amazing. And this is kind of another thing, you know, but that stuff is brilliant and fun and creative, and I applaud it. But I find it, you know, I find these kind of moral panics cynical, disgusting, and ultimately offensive. But, you know, that's my soapbox. Sorry, I yield my time. Also, the game you guys are mentioning, I remembered. I didn't think it was that crazy.
It wasn't. That's the whole point. Like, I mean, and if you watch the documentary, it shows you more of the context, and it's actually laughably bad and, like, not scary or particularly violent at all. And they went to such great lengths to make it as inoffensive and tame as possible, and yet these, you know, kind of puritanical lawmakers still glommed onto one particular scene taken out of context. There's a really good quote in the article I'm talking about with Rob Halford, kind of reflecting back on the case. And in this article, they ultimately, and what, you know, the case kind of rested on was their intent. And then the defense of the band was more looking into the state of mind of these young men who are obviously massive Judas Priest fans. And the writer makes the point that makes it all the more heartbreaking that this is how, you know, or this was the circumstance under which they lost their lives and kind of the legacy they left behind to kind of like run their favorite band up the flagpole and kind of pillory them in this very public way. But it all came down to these young men had substance abuse problems and depression issues, and that they likely would have done this either way without any intervention from some sort of deus ex machina in the form of, like, you know, hidden messages on a Judas Priest song, which, mm-hmm. again, like you said, Ben, is very tame and radio friendly.
Well, this is the last thing I'll say here on this, and I appreciate that you're bringing up this point. Think of it this way. Somebody eats a tuna melt, and they've eaten tuna melts in the past. Maybe not every day, but, you know, they like a melt. And then one day, this person who's eating a tuna melt goes and commits some horrific crime or injures themselves or someone else. This is sort of like saying, now we need to get rid of tuna melts. It's like it's misattributing the cause.
100%. And you know, in this article, Halford really goes quite in depth into his understanding of the history of backmasking, and, you know, traces it back to where he first heard about it, which was in, like, Led Zeppelin songs, for example. But what is that, the one where it's like Stairway to Heaven? It says, like, my sweet Satan, there was a little tool shed where he made us suffer. Oh, my sweet Satan. It does kind of sound like that. I've definitely heard that flipped. But it's like one of those things where it's like, did Pink Floyd make The Dark Side of the Moon with the intention of syncing it up to The Wizard of Oz? It works. You can do it. It's really cool. But was their intent? I don't know. Maybe with the Zeppelin Sweet Satan line there is, but you'd never hear that. That's a different kind of backmasking, right? That's you're hearing it forward and then you play it backwards. So you have to choose to play the record backwards to even hear the message. Whereas I think with the Halford case or the Priest case, it was in the record already backwards. Murray, please let us know if I'm getting that wrong. But he makes a really great point, Halford, in this interview, where he says, either way, my interpretation of subliminal messages as we presented it is how in the old days you'd go to a movie and someone would insert a frame of film that suggested you buy popcorn. But even then, it was real and it was physical because you could take that frame and go, look, there it is. You can't do that with words because you have to actually hear them. And then if you could hear them, then how can they be subliminal or subconscious, like in a dream?
I think that's a great point. The basic concept that backwards words somehow being turned in the listener's mind into frontwards words, and then those concepts become attached to you know, an action that is taken. Pretty laughable. So yeah, I do agree. That's insane. Yeah. Baskward Mashkreshmer.
Exactly. It may, whenever I hear, think about this, I always think of the, what is he called? The dream, the dream man from the Twin Peaks series who speaks backwards. You know, that guy had to learn how to do that. And it's really hard. And it really takes you a lot of effort to even hear what he's trying to say. You really need the subtitles a lot of times. I think he's called just the man from the dream. But I, by the way, it was, I was confusing some things. So I believe Murray was saying they inserted backwards syllables into their record, like in a, like behind the actual mix. And I believe in the Judas Priest case, they're saying that these phrases were hidden in forwards, you know, phrases that you had to play backwards to actually hear, I think. So let me know if I got that right, Murray. But yeah, really great points, really amazing story. Clearly a test case that didn't turn out. I hope you sold at least a decent amount of records and singles, but maybe it wasn't the magic bullet that you were hoping it would be. But I love the fact that you gave this a go. But yeah, looking forward to hopefully one day meeting in person. And thanks again for the email. And we'll take a quick break and then be back with more listener mail.
Welcome back to the show. And now we are turning to our voicemail system to get the next message. It comes from an anonymous individual. This is what they had to say.
Hey, fellas. Here's an idea for a show. I don't know if you're familiar with Thomas Merton, but there's some speculation that the CIA may have assassinated him, which is kind of crazy, but given all the, he was a pacifist, he was died in 68, so conceivably I could see some nut job at the CIA being like, you have to stop this guy. He's going to hurt our chances in Vietnam. But anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out. Talk to you later.
The CIA assassination?
Yeah, a pacifist or somebody who did not, who was speaking publicly and had some clout about something the government didn't want them to be speaking about. Yeah.
Okay. CIA is in Central Intelligence Agency, not Cheese Inventors Association.
Correct. That and was also, yeah, also not the Catholic institution of atrocities. I don't know.
Anointment?
Yeah. It's a really interesting thing that you're posing here, whoever you are. We will call you Monktastic. Nope. We will call you
Snakebutt. Okay. No, that's it.
Yeah, sure. We'll call you Snakebite. I like it. Let's do Snakebite.
Let Snakebite fly.
Let's let Snakebite fly. Flying Snakebite, terrifying. So yes, I personally did not know much about Thomas Merton. The name rang a bell as soon as you said it, and seeing pictures of this person, if you look online and look at a picture of Thomas Merton, he may look familiar to you. Perhaps many of you listening out there who were born maybe in the 50s would definitely recognize Thomas Merton. He was a name. He was a thinker and a pacifist and somebody who others listened to. And that has a lot to do with why he was in Bangkok, Thailand when he met his demise, because he was speaking at a public engagement there. Or I guess it was, I don't know if it was public or private, but he was at a speaking engagement where he was a speaker. So what I want to do really quickly, just to kind of ground us in Thomas Merton, is to look at some reporting out of the Irish Times from, it looks like 2015, 2018, and then maybe actually a bit from Britannica, because, hey, you can still use Encyclopedia Britannica. It's just online now. It's not quite as extensive as it once was.
Well, and it's free, right? You don't have to like buy the whole set from like a traveling salesman or any, or at least, well, it was used to be like an 800 number, but
yeah,
remember the days of traveling salesmen selling encyclopedias? I missed
it. Yes, definitely. I don't miss the traveling salesman.
The nostalgia of it is nice.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, let's go to Britannica first, then we'll hop over to the Irish Times. So Britannica says that this person, Thomas Merton, also known as Father M. Lewis, was born in 1915, January 31st to be exact. And he was a poet, a writer, and most notably, he was a monk. He was a Trappist monk, which is a really cool thing. You may be familiar with the term Trappist from some of the beer that you enjoy if you are of drinking age. But
La Fin du Monde.
Oh, yes.
Excellent beer. Excellent name.
There are many beers in the Trappist style, some of which are still produced in the Trappist style at monasteries, which is a very cool thing, very cool tradition. And it's a weird thing that me growing up in the church, I never would have thought monks would in any way be associated with alcohol, at least not in the creation and selling of alcohol. But it's an old, old thing that's been going on for a long time. I mean, I don't want to read directly from Britannica here, but honestly, I don't know much about Thomas Merton. So we're kind of learning this together as we go. He did a lot of moving. He had an interesting life, American-born mother, New Zealand-born father. They were artists. They were living in France. He was baptized in the Church of England. You know, he was baptized in the Church of England, and then his life with some kind of church, some kind of religious movement continued until his death in 1968. And you can learn a ton about him. And maybe if we do a bigger episode on this, if it merits it, we'll go into all of that and his background. What you do need to know is that he was in Thailand, and the circumstances surrounding his death are a little weird. Even now, if you're attempting to find out exactly what happened to him, you may have some trouble because the exact details are somewhat unknown. A lot of it comes from the report of the two people that came upon his body when they found him, and how those stories have kind of changed over time, how that game of telephone has altered some of the understanding there. As well as the official information coming from medical professionals and investigators who dealt with his body and with the investigation into his death. Officially, he died by heart attack. At least that's what was recorded.
It's also maybe electric shock, right?
It could be electric shock. It could be only electric shock. It could be electric shock that caused a heart attack, or it could be something completely different. There are rumors all over the internet that you could find that he had a head wound when he was found. That is, I would say that's a rumor still. I haven't been able to fully conclude that that is actually what happened.
Shades of McRae, though. Shades of Willie McRae there.
Right? Right? So let's talk about where he was found. I want to go to the Irish Times now. There's an article you can find titled, "The Turbulent Monk, Did the CIA Kill Vocal War Critic Thomas Merton?" It was published December 3rd, 2018. And if you go through here, they, by the way, call Thomas Merton, quote, "the most vocal critic of war," which is really interesting. So again, I feel terrible coming into this without doing more research, but I know for certain in everything I'm reading, he was very, very anti-war and was not quiet about it. And he was influential. So we can imagine, as you stated, listener, that could be a reason why someone would want to stop him from continuing to talk. In this article from the Irish Times, they state that he was found dead in his room near Bangkok, where he had been the main speaker at an international monastic conference. They state that the cause of death given by the Thai police was heart attack, and there was no autopsy performed on him because I can't say because likely due to the fact that there was a conclusion made early on in the investigation that there was no foul play, even though when he was found, he was wearing shorts and he was lying on his back, I believe. And on top of him was a fan, like a stand-up fan. I don't know what you call that. Just a fan on a stand. Feels like I'm trying to rhyme. But an electric fan that had toppled over onto his chest when he was found. Now, whether that was due to a struggle, I don't know. The investigators didn't really say whether that was due to an accident. It just fell on top of him. And whether or not that fan actually electrocuted him or not is unknown. However, the two people that came and found him when they initially saw his body lying there, or when they saw him lying there, unknowing if he was alive or dead, attempted to pick up the fan. And according to their stories, there was a smaller electric shock that went in, that went through their hand when they attempted to pick up the fan.
Got it.
There are, you know, who knows? If you continue reading this Irish Times article, they state this person named Jim Douglas, who was an associate of Merton, publicly raised this concept that perhaps there was a cover-up, that Thomas Merton was in fact murdered by somebody. But again, proving who it was, how, why, seems to be impossible at this time. There's a person named Matthew Fox, who's a theologian. He's the guy that stated that the CIA may have been involved, mm-hmm. because there were active agents in Thailand, according to Matthew Fox. And he says that one of these agents at some point made contact with him and told him this story, where they infiltrated the living quarters of Thomas Merton, or the place where he was staying in Bangkok, Thailand, and killed him. Again, that's a story from somebody else that ends up getting printed somewhere without full verification.
This feels like a full episode, Matt, because I have been able to find documents from the Thai government regarding mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. And then a really great article written by David Martin and Hugh Turley called What We Know About Thomas Merton's Death.
Yes. Yes, 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 yes.
Available on the martyrdomofthomasmerton.com. There's a lot to the story, but right now, without digging in deeper, which of course we will do, right now it's tough to say, it's tough to connect a lot of dots to the CIA, right? Unless mm-hmm. we get more information. We know that the CIA is pro-war. The CIA is pro-assassination, by which I mean they're not opposed to either of those tactics in pursuit of a goal. And we know that this guy was very much a pacifist, very much anti-war. But there are a lot of pacifists. There are quite a few anti-war activists. And while many of them get monitored by the CIA or the FBI or whatever, you know, spoonful of alphabet soup you like, they don't usually get killed. They don't always get killed. They have to be pretty prominent. So my first question is, are there more dots that we can connect? And secondly, was there something that he was going to do? And did his death prevent that from coming to pass? Because I believe you mentioned this. He was only 53.
Yeah, I did not mention that. He was only 53 when he passed away. And his posthumous bibliography is impressive. The amount of works that have come out since his death, it's pretty incredible. You can find a full list of those at the Thomas Merton Center at Bellarmine University, Bellarmine University. It goes through and it shows a chronology of his publications starting in, it gives his life timeline basically with the publications that he made. And then if you go further down, it has this posthumous publication starting in 1969, running all the way to 2016.
So these would have been like works that his trust gathered up and published on his behalf after he passed, or the family?
He was a prolific writer of everything from, you know, personal notes to other people to, you know, personal writing, like journaling kind of things, to just
meditations.
Meditations and things, doctrine. Things a minister would do, you know, that a priest would do, essentially. Writing out thoughts in that way to be presented. And again, a public speaker. So who knows what they actually would have prevented, if they did prevent anything, if someone did in fact kill him. Mm-hmm. A lot of ifs there, of course. But hey, thank you so much, whoever you are, that that sent that voicemail in. We do appreciate it, and I can't wait to look more into this. Thomas Merton seems like a very fascinating person.
Oh my God, mm-hmm. yes.
Anyone who takes up the life of a monk is interesting to me, because I feel like that doesn't happen often in a vacuum. Interesting, perhaps tragic things happen in everyone's lives, right? But when you decide to put the robes on and live that life, there's got to be something worth looking into to at least tell mm-hmm. a story about.
No, I'm sorry, man. I'm just laughing because you said live that life. I had a picture of like a Franciscan or a Trappist monk saying, yeah, I'm about that life, son. Mm-hmm. But
or like having like a chest tattoo that says like priest life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. There is a place I'd like to shout out. I have a great interest in people who dedicate their lives to something spiritual on that level, to that level of extremity. So there is a fantastic monastery not too far from Atlanta called Our Lady of the Holy Spirit. I spent a lot of time there, and those folks are really chill. Like they're other than like their first answer for most things being that you should convert to Catholicism, they're super chill guys. I don't know. I mean,
they wouldn't speak with us for a documentary back in the day, but that's okay.
Which one? The Green Burial one?
No, something a couple of my friends and I were working on in college, but we really wanted to talk to somebody, but they wouldn't do it.
Oh, we'll try and get, yeah, I've got a connect if you want to get your college.
They wanted to sell me a lot of stuff in the gift shop, but anyway, no, I'm not, no shade. It's just, I didn't have as great an experience there.
Oh yeah. I hear you. I gotta say that like of all the publications that are mentioned in this story, I am fascinated by this book you mentioned, The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton, Investigation. Really interested to see how they kind of dissect this narrative, you know, around the accident, because there are a lot of very fishy details in this story.
Ooh. Yeah. And you can go to places like edwardcurtin.com, check out reviews of that. You can also, actually, this one was tailored for us, you guys. There's a Huffington Post article published in 2011 titled The Thomas Merton Book They Don't Want You to Read.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Totally worth it. It's, you know, if you're looking for something to read, check out The Seven Story Mountain. That's, I think, his autobiography. Maybe not. It's one that he wrote. That people say is worth your time. So anyway, that's what we know about Thomas Merton. Now we will come back to look at the circumstances surrounding his death more very soon. Thanks so much. We'll be right back after another word from our sponsor.
Welcome back, fellow conspiracy realists. Quick update. I've made some peace with the good folks over at Lucky Jack. And did not mean to be disparaging in my earlier comments. You like that? Instant retraction on the show, you guys. I don't want any bad blood.
Does it get better after it's in your stomach for a while?
You know what? Maybe that's it. You know, maybe I was just being a curmudgeon and I need to try to drink more fancy coffee. But maybe there's a conspiracy afoot. Maybe Lucky Jack just tastes better with every sip. You guys can have that tagline. Because it might be literally true in my case. But this final piece of listener mail is also about a conspiracy. And it comes to us from Silent Slevin, S-L-E, number 7, E-N. So I'll cut right to the chase. Don't need a preamble. Matt, Doc, this one in particular is for you guys. The title is this. Potentially the biggest conspiracy in gaming history. Silent says, afternoon, gentlemen, and the not-to-be-forgotten Doc. This one is quite a doozy, but could have huge implications if true. The short version. People suspect that Hideo Kojima, most notably the creator of the Metal Gear series, is behind a seemingly small indie studio releasing an upcoming demo to a mysterious game that many suspect is a tease for a new Silent Hill. The story is time-sensitive, as this demo is now expected to release on Friday, June 25th. So by the time you hear this week's listener mail, this demo, if everything's legit, will have come out. One of the larger overall implications, says Silent, is that Kojima's fallout from Konami has all been a stunt since 2015. And Silent, you went on to include some links to some Reddit threads that talk more in depth about the story. And you say, if you've heard of this already, I hope you're enjoying the fun in the thought of this being true. If not, welcome to the rabbit hole. Best regards. Silent S. This is a cool one. We've got some Hideo Kojima fans in the Stuff They Don't Want You to Know family. He's done a lot of pretty crazy stuff. What do you guys remember him for specifically?
I mean, I think for sure it's Metal Gear, right? For me. And I mean, for me, that's all day, except for that weird one they made. I don't know if he even had a part in that.
Which was
weird
the one,
one
where like you're like crawling around on the ground for the first 45 minutes of the game?
No. No, it's the one where you're a badass named Snake and you do all the cool badass stuff.
No, but there's one, a recent one where you're like in a hospital bed and you escape and you're literally crawling around like kind of, you know, without full use of your limbs. He really commits to the realism, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm. He's super into perambulation and it reminds me of, you know, I was really excited when he released Death Stranding, which was so cool. Mysterious. And then critics called it a walking simulator. But then in their reviews...
I was just about to say something about Death Stranding.
Yeah. Okay, wait. Did you play it, Doc?
No, I didn't. I briefly considered it. It was like, okay, when they first started talking about it, I was like, no, that doesn't really sound interesting at all to me because it kind of sounded like a UPS simulator almost. But then like once it actually came out and I heard other people talking about it, I was like, that actually sounds pretty good. And it got some really good reviews. I think it won some video game awards, if my memory serves me correctly.
Wait, when you say and UPS also, simulator, genius, so. Do you mean like UPS, like you're like a delivery man or something like that?
Yeah, he's delivering packages like in this sort of like post-apocalyptic sort of space, you know? And that's a really big part of the game is him delivering these packages and you having to figure out a way to like make it across this terrain. Sorry, people, this isn't really spoilers, but you're like making it across this terrain without, you know, falling over with all of your packages on your back.
Yeah, it's hard to walk in the game. That's the crazy, like when you read the critics' reviews, the thing that cracked me up about it, and I haven't ended up playing the game. I just read everything about it. The critics' reviews are like, Death Stranding is mainly a walking simulator. 5 out of 5 stars. It was a very weird way to phrase the review, but...
Just watch the Video Game Donkey coverage of it, and you'll feel like you've played it, and you'll laugh, and you'll cry, and that's all you need. But also, you know, support the creators of the game. But
sure.
Video Game Donkey is all you need.
But also, of course, he's a genius and had like a huge level of respect for him based on his history in the gaming industry. So he also like takes himself and his work very seriously, which I'm not saying is a bad thing, but I know people who were very like sort of anti Death Stranding and thought it sounded stupid when it first came out and then they played it and loved it. So it's been sort of on my list to get to, but my backlog is so long. I just don't think I'm going to make it to it.
He strikes me as almost like the type of luminary to the video game industry that like Hayao Miyazaki is to like the animation industry.
I think it's a fair comparison. Yeah. In terms of the conspiracy, here's where the rabbit hole leads us. The story starts with a PlayStation 5 game called Abandoned. Back in April, Sony said, we've got this project coming from a Dutch company called Blue Box Game Studios. We can't tell you much about it, but get hyped. And from there, this beautiful, weirdly intricate conspiracy theory emerged, arguing that A, the game does not actually exist, and that B, it is instead a secret new project from Hideo Kojima. And this thing just like it blew up. So Silent S is not alone in being fascinated by this idea. People who believe in the theory or were at least interested in it set up a subreddit just to examine the mystery. It's weird to me because in a way, Kojima has kind of created his own mythology. You know, like if this were any other kind of video game creator, people would probably not be so quick to jump aboard a conspiratorial train. But he's done weird conspiratorial stuff in the past. He's made fake companies. He's hired actors, you know?
Yeah. I want to go back to Death Stranding right there. Yeah. Isn't it Guillermo del Toro that ends up in Death Stranding, like one of the trailers?
He's in it. Yeah, he's in the game, I think.
Because there was some weirdness with Guillermo and the game they were working on before Death Stranding. I don't remember all of the stuff. It's kind of hard for me to pull all the details, but I know that he does things like that. He does nods to rumors, to stuff that's happening in real life, like within the game world sometimes. And, you know, if you even look at the Metal Gear Solid franchise, the whole thing is this very poetic statement about war and nuclear weapons and mass destruction and the need for, you know, dominance by one tribe over another tribe. It's done very symbolically through this storyline, right? Mm-hmm. And I love that he does that with his and melding real world and fiction worlds together in that way. I don't know. It feels more to me, Ben, that the gaming world and fans of Kojima and of video games in general so very want a Silent Hill game to exist.
Yeah.
Like, I know I do. That demo that came out, Doc, what was it called? There was a demo for the next Silent Hill game. It had the dude, from The Walking Dead in it. And anyway, I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, I don't remember. Sorry.
I think it was called Silent Hills. There was a demo made for it that I went crazy over. I couldn't believe how it felt to experience the demo, but then it ended up getting canceled. Silent Hills. Yeah, that's what it was called. Like, I personally so badly want that game to be real that the possibility that this other game, Abandoned, might be a Kojima Silent Hill game just hiding for political reasons or whatever makes my heart go a flutter. But I can't imagine that could be real. But who knows? It's hard to discount anything when it comes to Hideo.
Hideo Kojima probably knows, I would guess. But he doesn't seem super into telling people. So this gets in a little bit, we're getting a little bit in the weeds here, but this is interesting. Because this theory blew up so quickly, part of this hype comes from a tweet on June 15th from these folks, Blue Box. They've deleted the tweet, but they said the following. Hear me out on this. They said, quote, guess the name, Abandoned equals parentheses, first letter S, last letter L, in parentheses, reveal closing in ... And then they say, hashtag PS5, hashtag exclusive. For the big Silent Hill fans, that feels like a smoking gun, right?
Yeah. They would love, this tiny little studio would love for you to think they're associated with Silent Hill.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point about it too. There is some leveraging, right? Some opportunism, or at least some, they're capitalizing on stuff. The issue is that the head of the studio, the head of Blue Box, a guy named Hassan Karaman, he came forward and said, yeah, no, look, we don't actually have anything to do with this. And Kojima's fans did not believe him.
Yeah. It's too late. Like, you opened that box.
You're an actor. Admit it. And he's like, no, I'm a game developer. That's like my job. I have this studio. We make video games. And people still didn't believe him until they found out that he had been posting on some forums for game developers for months and months and months. So he looked like he was legit. This happens a lot of times with any kind of conspiracy. People want it to be so true, so profoundly, that they ignore what's actually happening. And Blue Box Games keep saying, absolutely none of this is true. Maybe you all are spending too much time on the internet. But then I think, you know, to your point, Matt, everybody wants that game to be real. You know, so intensely do they want this that they're not going to let facts get in the way of a good story.
And also, that's what they would say. You know what I mean? Like, right. They wouldn't come clean just yet. So, you know,
that's a really
just putting that out there.
That's a really good point.
Like guys.
Yeah.
Guys, did you even take into account that this guy's initials, HK, are the same as Hideo Kojima?
We're blowing this thing wide open. This is going to be the episode that spells doom for our show. This is going to be the line we weren't supposed to cross. While we're here, I think it gives us a glimpse into how quickly these things can proliferate and how quickly they can fall apart. If you'd like to learn more, check out Kotaku.com's article, Hideo Kojima Conspiracy Theory Ends with Tears, because it looks like these rumors just don't hold up. One great example of this, or one sad example for the true believers, comes to us from a reporter from Bloomberg named Jason Schreier. So Schreier is not, you know, a huge video game fan, but he was really interested in watching this theory develop online in real time. And he started out kind of on board with it, but as he was digging in, you know, as investigative reporters do, he found more and more holes with these theories. First, Blue Box had a history of failed Kickstarter campaigns going back years and years and years, and that made it increasingly unlikely that it was a front for some new top secret Kojima game. And so another nail in the coffin here is that Blue Box, when they were answering some of their own questions or riddles that they cryptically posted on the internet, their answers seemed to discount these theories, right? That Kojima would somehow be involved. So it may be all sound and fury signifying nothing, because increasingly a lot of people are convinced that this studio was, as Kotaku puts it, quote, bullshitting around to build hype for its low budget horror game. That again, for the true believers, these are all red herrings, right? This is a school of red herrings, and they and only they can see the truth, and everybody else will have to eat crow, eat humble pie, whatever figure of speech you want to use, once this game comes out. And you know, Doc, Matt, I am not the biggest gamer. So I was interested to read about this, but even for someone who's not as plugged in like me, it is a fascinating study in how these ideas generate. And I'm wondering if you all would like to play a little bit, not to sound like somebody from a horror movie, but if you all would like to play a game with me, I bet you that we could do a little ARG kind of stuff ourselves. I bet you we could create a conspiracy theory and propagate it. And people would believe it, despite the fact that I am on air pitching this idea to you right now.
Well, yeah, but it's just in this episode. Because, I mean, we make so many at this point, it's going to get buried so fast. Nobody will remember that we are actively doing a conspiracy in 2022.
Are we all in? Are you in?
It's already happening. Like I said, it's 2022 right now. Mm-hmm. just remembering talking about this.
There we go. I like it.
I'm down. So I just want to say there's a real danger here. It's a good and bad thing, but I would say often it turns out to be a terrible thing for video game companies as they're trying to just hype the absolute living crap out of their games. Yeah. And, you know, I was going to do a fun reveal or something, but, you know, there's this one game I remember that had so much hype for it.
Oh, wow.
And I was so excited to get it and I couldn't wait. And then everybody's started popping out. And
for anyone who can't, this isn't on our YouTube channel, you're just hearing the audio version, let me narrate what happened. Matt just slowly he held up an object really close to the camera, and then he pulled away, and it was E.T. for Atari.
Yeah, it was E.T. So much hype.
So many popping so out hype in that game.
God, please, let's remember to bleep those D's. Okay, cool. Sorry about that, guys. That's my fault. No, but seriously, the
hype.
Just the hype on Cyberpunk, like, it hasn't necessarily ruined a company, but it's taken away a lot of the goodwill, like a tremendous amount of goodwill that gamers had for one specific company, yeah. CD Projekt Red.
Huge blemish on their record.
And it was because of the hype, man. I'm telling you, if this was just a cool game coming out, they could have said, oh, no, we'll push it back again, which they should have, but they didn't.
I think about that a lot, too. You know, it's something that's become the norm over the past decade or so as more and more people are accustomed to a world of ubiquitous, nonstop information about every tiny development. I reached a point, I'm a person who loves spoilers. I reached a point where I thought, you know, if there's a film or a project or an album that's coming out and I know I'm going to love it, just tell me about it like a month before. Don't tell me, you know, in 5 years, you know, like in 6 years, right?
Yeah. And even then, don't tell me that much about it. Just let me know that, hey, you're probably going to like this. And I'll go, let me see. Keyword, keyword. Yes. Oh, action verb, keyword. Yep, I'm in.
And definitely don't send Keanu Reeves out to get my hopes about it.
Yeah, I remember you were pretty upset about that one. Everybody was kind of afraid to talk to you on the call. Yeah.
And I was so excited.
Yes. Yeah, you know, it's true. And there is a marketing machine and it does help a lot of people by the fact of its existence. But I wonder if we really need it. You know, I mean, marketing itself is inherently conspiratorial. I guess they want to get pre-orders or something. And look, we've gone pretty far in the weeds on this, but Silent, thank you for bringing this to our attention. We'll keep an eye out. And you know what? If Hideo comes forward and is like, wahaha, I got you all, Silent Hills, then I'm going to be the first person to go on air on our show and say that these theories were correct. At this point, it looks like it would be pretty difficult for them to be correct, but there's not hard proof that they're not yet. But other than, other than the studio saying we didn't do it.
Sorry.
Yeah. But as Doc pointed out, of course, that's what they would say.
Man, you're so right. You're so right. Well, in the meantime, if you're looking for a Silent Hill game, just go play Resident Evil Village. The Village, whatever it is. It's the 8th one. It looks like it's going to be pretty great. I haven't played it yet.
And with that, we would love to hear from you. If you are interested in video game conspiracies, check out our earlier video on Polybus, I believe it's called.
Polybius.
Polybus.
We called it Polybius, but I think it's Polybius, maybe? Polybius. I don't know.
Well, check out that video. Let us know what you think. Thanks to Anonymous. Thanks to Murray. And as we said earlier, thanks to Silent. So if you would like to take a page from your fellow conspiracy realist book, why not write to us? We can't wait to hear from you, especially if you have suggestions for topics we should cover in the future. And we try to make it easy to find us online.
That is correct. We are pretty easy. Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter and Facebook. Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. And you can also find us personally on Instagram and Twitter and places. Ben, what are your handles?
All right. Well, quid pro quo, Clarice. Matt, if I say it, you have to say it. You have to give away yours as well.
Cool. All right.
All right. The covenant has been made. So you can find me at Ben Bolin, B-O-W-L-I-N, on Instagram. You can get a behind-the-scenes peek on the research that's going into stuff they don't want you to know, any other number of misadventures, including when I end up outside of the country, at Ben Bolin HSW on Twitter. But if you are a person of taste and class, then there is another Instagram you should follow, and that is the Instagram of our very own Matt Frederick. Like yes. That setup? Now you basically have to say something.
Oh, man, now I have to. You can find me at Night City Net Stunter 69. That's my Instagram handle. You can check that out.
Wait, what was it again, just so everybody remembers?
Night City, like night and then city, Net Stunter 69. Stunter.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my handle. You'll All right. find it. You'll find it. And then if you don't want to do social media, we also have a phone number that you can actually call us and leave a message. Our number is 1-833-STD-WYTK.
You'll have 3 minutes. Those 3 minutes are yours. Just let us give yourself a sick nickname. Let us know what you'd like us to call you. Most importantly, let us know whether or not we can use your name and voice and message on the air. Tell us what's on your mind. If you have something personal that you just want to share with our crew, but you don't want it getting all over a podcast, that's fine. Just put it at the end. Even more importantly than that, if you have a story, if you have an idea that needs more than 3 minutes, then don't feel like you have to censor yourself. Don't feel like you have to edit yourself. Just write to us directly. We read every single message we receive at our good old-fashioned email address, which is
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.